On this edition of Celebrating Science, Professor Brian Schmidt on piecing together the mysteries of the universe from beginning to end. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, The Universe from Beginning to End, Brian Schmidt describes the life of the universe. Astronomers use observations to trace its history back more than 13 billion years. But with this data comes a puzzling picture of two mysterious substances, dark matter and dark energy. Professor Schmidt will describe experiments that are monitoring a struggle between dark energy and dark matter, and how understanding these elusive pieces of our universe may one day help predict the ultimate fate of the cosmos. Dr. Schmidt received his doctorate in physics at Harvard University in 1993. He is a Federation Fellow at the Australian National University's Mount Stromlo Observatory. Dr. Schmidt has received numerous awards and honors for his contributions to science. He is also a Fellow of the Australian Academy of Sciences, a Fellow of the United States National Academy, and a foreign member of the Spanish Royal Academy of Sciences.
Welcome, everyone, and it's a great pleasure to be here this evening, and I'm especially honored by just the sheer number of people here tonight, because although I get to give a lot of talks, I'm afraid this is probably the largest audience I've ever had the privilege of giving a talk to, and so I thank you for all coming tonight. So today I'm going to be talking about the universe from beginning to end. Of course, I won't be talking about everything in great detail, but I want to give you a sense of why we think the universe is the way it is, and basically a story of how astronomers, such as myself, who look at the universe through telescopes, see the universe. And so this year is the celebration of the invention of the telescope by Galileo. Now, those of you who are in the know will know that Galileo did not actually invent the telescope. He was just the first person who knew how to use one properly, which was to look at the stars. And so it is an important milestone in science, because before Galileo could use the telescope, we really had a theoretical view of the cosmos. Most of us will have known of Copernicus, who took the idea that the Earth was not the center of the universe, but simply going around the sun. And that was an idea which was Copernicus's, but he was largely ignored by most of the world. And it was Galileo who went through and actually looked at the heavens and saw mountains on the moons, or, for example, saw Jupiter. Jupiter, the planet, looked like this to it. It was a sort of a fuzzy orb to him, but it had four moons that went around the planet regularly. Clearly, those moons were not going around the Earth. Seeing was believing. The Earth was not the center of the universe, at least of everything. This violated the fundamental view of the religious orthodoxy at the time. It's one of the things that got him into big trouble, but it did convince the world that Copernicus was right. So, with that in mind, let's take a quick tour of the universe to get ourselves on the same page. The universe is an interesting place. It's very large. And so we're going to use as a ruler for tonight's the speed of light. So we're using the speed of light because it's the one thing I can think of, and which astronomers can think of, which can sort of get us from small scales, which are scales of the solar system, out to the vast scales that are cosmology. So light travels 300,000 kilometers every second. So that's about 7.5 times every second around the Earth. And so we're going to use that as our ruler to take a tour through the universe so we're all on the same page. So the Earth-Moon system is 1.5 light seconds. So that means when Neil Armstrong went and did his memorable quote in 1969, 40 years ago, that we actually heard him 1.5 seconds after he made that pronouncement. The Sun is 5 light seconds across. I think most of us forget how big the Sun is relative to the Earth and the Moon. The Sun is really huge compared to the Earth. I was always aware that it took light 8 minutes. That's sort of the fact they give you in high school about light travel. 8 minutes for light to get from the Earth to the Sun, or vice versa. And our solar system, if you believe it extends out to Pluto, that's a bit of an interesting question now. Actually, it's not so much the solar system, it's whether or not Pluto is a planet or not. The IAU at the last meeting decided Pluto was not a planet. I will have you know that I voted against that motion. I still think Pluto should be a planet, but I'm afraid that I was voted down, me and several of my colleagues. Maybe there's hope. The problem is Pluto is not alone. There are certainly other things like Pluto out there, and I guess we decided it was more important to sort that out than anything. But 10 light hours, that's how long it takes light to get out to Pluto. It's 10 hours. If we move on to a star that you can see in Australia, Alpha Centauri, it's not very visible from Canada unless you can see underground, is 4.3 light years in distance. And so Alpha Centauri is a star very much like our own sun. They're sort of twin stars. And if you think, just to get the scale of how big the universe is, if our sun were a pea and Alpha Centauri were another pea, well, then Alpha Centauri would be roughly located at Ottawa from here, with everything else in between space. So space is well named because there's a lot of space in the universe. But this is in one of the densest places in the universe, which is a galaxy. And so we live in the Milky Way, which contains roughly 100 billion stars, which our sun is a fairly normal but maybe slightly bigger than average star. And we are 30,000 light years from the center of this big, dense blob of matter in the universe. So this is not a picture of the Milky Way. It's actually a picture of a nearby galaxy that has the romantic name of NGC 891. And just to show you what we would look like, this is looking, if you imagine this thing sort of looking like a fried egg, if we were to look at it from above, we live in a spiral galaxy located not too far from a spiral arm. Is again 30,000 light years from the center. So moving on just to the nearest part of around our galaxy, we have several galaxies that are near us. We have the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds located a mere 180,000 light years from the Milky Way. They actually are satellites, like the moon goes around the Earth, they go around the Milky Way. And then we have the Andromeda and Triangulum spirals, which you can see if it's clear out tonight, or later in the year, and they're 2 million light years. Those are the nearest real galaxies in the sky. But the sky is full of galaxies, and in Australia and also in Northern Hemisphere, we've been mapping the cosmos. And this is a map done from Australia of the nearest billion light years. So light is taking a billion years from the edge of this diagram to reach us, and this contains 250,000 galaxies. Which are just the 250,000 brightest galaxies. There's a lot of faint ones that aren't even on this map. And you can see the cosmos spreads as sort of a foam, or a web as we like to call it, across the sky. If we look further and further afield with larger and larger telescopes, well, or in this case, not so much a large telescope, but as a very sensitive telescope, the Hubble Space Telescope in space, we can look back to roughly 12 billion years in the past. And so in this image, there is one star in the center. That's the big bright thing with spikes. And then everything else in that image is a galaxy. And so that is a tiny piece of sky, 1,000 times smaller than the moon. And it contains thousands of galaxies, the most distant of which are 12 billion light years. Now, astronomers like me like to build larger and larger telescopes because we can see further and further into the past. Although we have to be careful because the universe does not last forever. If we keep looking back furthest, we sort of run out of new galaxies, and instead what we see is this, not with an optical telescope, but with a microwave telescope. This is called the cosmic microwave background, and the little bumps and wiggles that you see here, which we'll talk briefly about at the end, but it's really another talk. For example, that little guy right there really represents roughly 10 to 100,000 galaxies worth of material. And here we're looking back to a time when the entire universe is glowing, because the universe was hot. It was a roughly 3,000 degrees centigrade, and it glowed just like the sun glows. The sun glows because it's hot. The universe glowed in the same way. And so we can't go much before that, because before that we reached the time of what we call the Big Bang. All right, so we've given a tour of the universe and all its scales. Let's look about how we understand and how the universe evolves over time. So to do that, I'm going to go back to the beginnings of what I think are the beginnings of cosmology. This man, Vesto Melvin Slipher, whose family actually gave me a scholarship when I was an undergraduate, I didn't know who he was, and you guys probably, lots of you don't know who he is either, but his job was to go and map canals on Mars for Percival Lowell, but he was really a scientist at heart, and so he spent his spare time taking the light of galaxies, spreading it out into the rainbow, which we call a spectrum, and if you do that for the sun, you get a rainbow, but it has bits of color missing. And those bits of color are really the fingerprints of atoms. Atoms, each atom, has a set of colors it will absorb light and take the light out. So most commonly we have sodium, which has two little colors of orange light, which it absorbs, or it can emit if you sort of heat the sodium up on its own. And so when you see lights around airports, for example, that have that orange glow to it, those are sodium lamps, and they glow because they're emitting that color. Well, the sun has sodium, and that sodium actually absorbs the light of the sun. And we can use that as sort of a benchmark to measure velocity. And so Slipher had the idea to go out and look at galaxies, which he didn't even know what they were at the time. And he saw that these galaxies were funny. They were all moving away from us, and he knew that because the light was stretched to the red. So light is a wave, and so you describe a wave by how far away the peaks and the troughs are from each other. When something is coming towards you, those peaks get compressed. If something's going away from you, those peaks get stretched out. Compression of light makes it blue. Stretching of light makes it red. So when he saw this, he saw that essentially every single galaxy had its light stretched to the red. And this was a big mystery at the time. It seemed that everything was moving away from us. And in 1916, we had sort of figured out that probably Copernicus was right. The Earth shouldn't be the center of anything. Why then would we suddenly have a situation where everything in the universe was more or less moving away from us? It made us a very special place in the universe, a very unpopular place in the universe, it would seem. So the way we figured this out was by doing some astronomy. And this was done by measuring distances. Now, astronomers are really bad at measuring distances because we don't have rulers out in space we can just lay down. So we have to resort to tricks or to things that don't work very well. And one of the tricks we use, and we still use today, and I'll be telling you a lot about, is what we call a standard light bulb. So imagine that you have a light bulb, that's let's say a 100-watt light bulb, and I have a little detector, such as a photovoltaic cell, that can count how much light comes from that light. So if that light bulb is 1 meter away and I move that light to half the distance, then that light will appear 4 times brighter. That's a physical law. Newton had it figured out that we call the inverse square law, that is things get fainter by the square of the distance. So if I have a 100-watt light bulb in space, then I will know the distance to an object. Now, the hard part is we don't have 100-watt light bulbs in space. And so we have to resort to, ingenious ideas or just anything that we can get away with. And the first person to do that was Edwin Hubble. And Edwin Hubble, in 1929, measured the brightness of the brightness star. So he said, well, I see stars and galaxies. Maybe the brightest stars are all the same. So if I have the brightest stars in this galaxy, and I compare them to the brightest stars in this galaxy, I can measure the relative distances by how faint the brightest stars are. Now, it turns out that assumption he made is good to a factor of 10, which sounds terrible, but actually for astronomy, that wasn't bad in 1929. And so he made that, and he found out that the larger the redshift, so the faster the object is moving away from us, the fainter the stars were in the galaxy. And from that measurement, he went out and he exclaimed in 1929 that the universe was expanding. Just to show you his data, this is the Hubble diagram, as we call it. We have velocity measured, 0, 500 kilometers per second, 1,000 kilometers per second. So that's, that speed would be equivalent to going across Canada in a few seconds. Here we have distance, and these are in astronomers' units. They weren't particularly accurate, but distance being nearby, far away. And the data are pretty ugly. Well, they were good to a factor of 10, it turned out. So the data, I always like to show this data because it's not very pretty looking data. And I'm going to show you my own data later on, and I reckon my data looks at least as good as this. And Hubble's a very famous guy, so I figure if he can get away with it, I can. So why would we say that the universe is expanding? Well, I'm going to do a little toy model of the universe, and thanks to the wonders of PowerPoint, I can expand my universe by 5%. I can decrease it, I can sort of play God here. And if I overlay my universe when I expand it from this point in the center, you can see that objects near that point are moved a little bit away when I've expanded the universe, but objects a long ways away, such as down here, have moved a lot. Now, if you convert that to a velocity, if I'm expanding the universe, the nearby objects, small velocity, the distant objects, large velocity. Furthermore, if I move and I just overlay this same image someplace else, like over there, I see exactly the same thing. So an expanding universe gives you Hubble's observation. The further away an object is, the faster it's moving away from us. Furthermore, every observer in the universe sees the same thing. Every observer sees what Hubble saw, and so it fixed the two big problems. Now, it turned out that Hubble said that he had no idea about the theory of general relativity's view on this. But Einstein's theory of gravity was happening, which we call general relativity, was being developed at the same time that Vesto Slipher was making his observations. Fortunately, astronomers were not considered physicists in this day and age, and we're barely considered physicists right now by most people. But astronomy was the thing that more or less confirmed Einstein's theory of general relativity. Observations made by Eddington, which probably Eddington was a theorist, and I think most people would say that Eddington probably cooked the books in proving general relativity, but he's given credit for it. The real observations were actually made 6 or 7 years later in 1922, and these showed that the sun bent space, caused light to travel a deviated path, just like Einstein predicted. And that was the first bit of proof, really, of general relativity. It was a prediction it made, really, from the thin air, Einstein's idea. But one of the things that Einstein's version of gravity said was that space should be expanding or contracting. Einstein, as we'll find out later, kind of hid that fact because astronomers of the day thought the universe was static. But in versions of Einstein, when we go and we look a long time in the past, then we're actually light. Instead of these galaxies physically moving away from us, what's happening is space is being created between us. And so light, remembering light that has short peaks to troughs, is blue light. This light, as it travels through the universe, gets stretched. And that gives us the redshift. All right. So imagine we have a universe which is expanding. I can put it in reverse. Universe is expanding. Let's put it in reverse. What happens? Everything gets closer and closer to itself, and you naturally get a time of the Big Bang when everything in the universe is on top of everything else. It's a natural thing. It's kind of hard to avoid in a universe that is expanding. So let's look at this on a graph and see if we can figure out what the expanding universe means. It's really going to tell us how old the universe is. So imagine I have a galaxy, two galaxies apart by some distance at a certain time. Now, I know the universe is expanding, so I'm going to extrapolate it back to when the galaxies have no separation. They're on top of each other. This is the rate the universe is expanding. This is the time of the Big Bang. So how fast the universe is expanding tells us how old the universe is. It tells us when everything on the universe was on top of everything else. So the Hubble constant tells us the age of the universe, and the number that astronomers have gotten in our units is called 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec, but if I convert that into units that you might be interested in, that's 14 billion years. Now, it turns out that as part of my thesis, my PhD thesis, my job was to measure the Hubble constant, the current rate that the universe is expanding. The person who hired me in Australia, Jeremy Mould, was just awarded the Gruber Prize, which I was awarded 2 years ago with the various teams for measuring this very accurately using the Hubble Space Telescope. And I'm proud to say that that team got the same answer that I got for my thesis, although I may have been a little lucky in my thesis to get the correct answer, as it seems. So that is how fast the universe is expanding right now, something equivalent to 14 billion years. But that's not really all the story. The universe, as it expands, is going to be slowed down by the effects of gravity. Gravity, just like when I throw a ball up in on the Earth, gravity pulls and slows the ball down, the universe feels the tug of gravity. And so the universe will slow down if there is a lot of gravity. Now, we know there has to be a little bit of gravity because we can see the stuff in the space. But it's very hard to judge exactly how much stuff there is in space. Certainly in the past, that was true. So let's look at our little diagram here if the universe is slowing down. So imagine, again, we have the same situation as last time. The universe is not slowing down at all. But if we have a universe that has lots of gravity, lots of stuff in it, it will slow down, and so we'll have a different trajectory. It will be expanding faster here and slow down, which means that the universe will not be as old as we think. In this case, it turns out that the universe is roughly two-thirds of the age we would expect. And so if the universe has a lot of stuff in it, instead of being 14 billion years old, it'll be more like 9.5 billion years old. Now, that might be a little problematic, it turns out, because we think the universe, from how old things are in it, is probably 12 billion years old. And astronomers, you know, would like to have the oldest things in the universe be older or younger than the universe is. So that was certainly been a problem. And one of the things that motivated trying to measure what was the trajectory of the universe would be by stuff I'll be telling you in just a second. Now, there's some consequences. If I can extrapolate things in the past, I can also extrapolate things to the future. So imagine I have a universe which has almost nothing in it. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Well, that is a universe that goes and lasts forever. It's an infinite universe. As I will show you in just a second, it's infinite both in time and spatially. It extends in all directions. On the other hand, a universe which is slowing down will do a trajectory where it will reach its maximum size and then starts to collapse. So here we have the Big Bang. This universe and its trajectory gives you the Gnab-Gib. That's the Big Bang backwards. So this is a fundamental question we have. Is the universe on a trajectory like this? This is certainly a nice scenario for the universe. I like it. It's very aesthetic. Infinity is so hard to understand. Why would we want an infinite universe? All right, but the universe is what it is. Aesthetics don't necessarily come into it. The slowing down or speeding up of the universe then tells us how old we think the universe is. It tells us the ultimate fate of the universe. It turns out it also tells us the shape and weight of the universe. So this is the Three Bears story, Goldilocks and the Three Bears story of the universe. We have the heavy universe, which is closed. What's closed mean? It means that the universe wraps onto itself in a fourth dimension. This is a universe which is finite. It is a universe that if I head out this direction, given enough time, I'll come back to where I started. Now, you might be thinking, how does that work? Well, fourth dimensions are really hard to think about. And I know people who think that they can visualize four dimensions. I try not to hang out with those people very well, very much. But mathematically, you can describe this, and that's what Einstein did with his equations of general relativity. We instead also have the light universe. This is a universe that has very little stuff in it. Space naturally likes to bend away from itself, according to Einstein. And so this is a universe which goes on to infinity, but has this funny saddle shape. So I'll show you in just a second. If you were to draw a triangle in this space, its angles will add up to less than 180 degrees. Finally, we have the just right universe. This is a universe that has just the right amount of stuff so that space neither bends away from itself or bends onto itself. It is what we say is flat. It's also just right because theorists many are at the Perimeter Institute, go through and try to understand the earliest times of the universe, right after the Big Bang, believe that the universe is just right. That if they would go through and predict that that's the way the universe should be. Now, observers such as me are really out to test those ideas. So here's a triangle just to show you that a triangle in that space looks like that. If you draw a triangle in this space, it adds up to more than 180 degrees. And indeed, if you were to try an experiment on the planet Earth, which has in three dimensions that shape, if you look at triangles on the surface of the Earth, they add up to more than 180 degrees in the same way they would in that space. All right, so imagine an experiment where we measure the universe's past. So I told you that for my thesis, I measured the expansion rate of the universe now. By looking at very distant objects, I'm looking into the universe's past. So astronomers have this really neat trick up our sleeves where we essentially have a time machine to look one direction. We can look into the past by looking at great distances. We can't look into the future, unfortunately. It's really a one-way thing. But imagine that I could measure the expansion rate now and then measure it into the past. If the universe has nothing in it, it's not slowing down or speeding up, that expansion rate will be the same as I look back in time. On the other hand, if the universe has a lot of stuff in it and is going to slow down, it's going to take a trajectory like this one. For example, on this side of the trajectory, gravity will win. The universe is finite. The universe will end sometime. On this side of the universe, if the trajectory is on this side of that line, then gravity loses. The universe expands forever. And finally, you can imagine a universe which is doing something unexpected, a universe which is not slowing down at all because of gravity, but is rather speeding up. And that would be an interesting universe indeed. So how are we going to do this experiment? Well, I told you we like using standard candles. Well, the best and biggest standard candle we have are type 1a supernovae. I used to call them the largest bangs in the universe after the big one, but they have so far been supplanted by something called gamma ray bursts, which would be an interesting talk for you to have sometime in the future. But today we're going to be talking about these things, which are the universe's largest thermonuclear bombs. So to understand what a type 1a supernova is, let me just give you a brief history of, for example, our sun. Our sun is right now 5 billion years old. About 5 billion years in the future, it's going to expand, become what we call a red giant, and eventually shrink down with the center of it collapsing down to what we call a white dwarf star. White dwarf star is roughly the size of the Earth but has a mass of the sun. So a teaspoon of material on one of these stars weighs tons. So it's an interesting star. Well, our sun isn't going to do anything interesting. It's just going to fade away into oblivion. On the other hand, imagine our sun had a sibling, another star, slightly smaller than it. The first star would do exactly what the sun did. It would collapse down to this white dwarf, and then the other star would eventually get big, but when it gets big, it'll start dumping material onto this white dwarf. And Chandrasekhar was one of the world's most famous physicists of all time, and certainly one of our most famous astronomers, showed that when one of those things becomes 1.38 times the mass of our sun, it becomes the world's largest nuclear bomb. It explodes with the power 5 billion times brighter than our sun. It produces most of the nickel and iron that we have, for example, on Earth, were formed in these explosions. And they go through, take about 20 days to reach maximum brightness, and then fade off into oblivion. But the beautiful thing is you have something which is more or less a standard candle, but instead of being 100 watts, it's a one with 43 zeros behind it, watts. So they really are the ticket. Now, it took technology a long time to figure out how to use these. In 1006 AD, the Chinese saw one of these in our own galaxy. And so they're very rare. There's only been three in this millennium. The last one was seen by Galileo himself, but Kepler was credited with the discovery. So these things are incredibly bright. This one was probably about the brightness of the moon when it's half lit. but would be in a point of light. And if you ever have had the ability to see like an iridium flare off a satellite, I've seen bright ones, and you sort of get these circles in your eyes where you have reflections in your eyes. This thing would have been like that and would have been able to be seen during the daytime. This is what that supernova looks like now, but not, it's seen in the X-rays, not in the optical. You can see it in the optical, but it's not nearly as interesting. These things, as I said, are very rare. Every 250, 300 years, one goes off in a galaxy like the Milky Way. So there's been a long time that people thought that maybe these type 1a supernovae would be a good thing to use. But it was really in the 1990s that technology of telescopes and detectors and computers allowed us to really use these effectively. And so two projects, one called the HiZ team, which I was the leader, the other one, the Supernova Cosmology Project, led by Saul Perlmutter, went through and sort of battled it out on telescope time allocation committees to get time to use these objects to measure the expansion of the universe. We were well known for not getting along in public places, although we're all friends now, sometimes. So what we would do is we'd go down to a telescope such as the Cerro Tololo 4-meter or the Canada-France Hawaii telescope. We would sip our Chardonnay as we watched the sky go past on one of these nights. And while this, we'd be collecting oodles and oodles of data. So this is an example of some of the data we'd collect. This is 1/8 of one frame that we would take, and we'd take one of these frames every couple minutes. In 1995, we were collecting roughly 50 gigabytes of data a night. That doesn't sound like too much now. It's a Blu-ray DVD worth of data. But unfortunately, there is actually some content in this, and like a Hollywood film. And so 5,000 galaxies in 1/8 of one of these pictures, we have to find the exploding star. And so I'll let you look at this for a second and see if you see the exploding star. Probably not going to jump out of you. I'll tell you it's right there. All right? It's this little guy. So this object is an exploding star. And you say, now, how on earth do you know that it's an exploding star? Well, like anything, I haven't given you a chance. We actually don't take one image. We take several images. And so here's an image of the 28th of April. And here is an image taken 24 days earlier. And you can see that nothing has become something. This object, outshining its galaxy, occurred 5 billion light years in distance. It occurred, it exploded before the Earth was formed. And that is the power of being able to look into the past. We can use that object to measure what the expansion rate of the universe is back 5 billion years. So, here's our experiment, where we did this for many times, our data from 1998. And it's the experiment I showed you. So let's just remind ourselves, the universe that is finite, and we were able to look 8 billion years into the universe's past. So here is the part where we expect the data to lie. If the universe is finite, it's going to eventually end. So each one of these points has an uncertainty, so this point can, what we would say is 68% of the time it lies from here to here. You can see that on average, these points could lie here, here, or here. However, as we go out here, none of these points are consistent with the universe that has this trajectory. The universe does not appear that it's going to end in a Gnab Gib. So I was kind of depressed when I saw this. Furthermore, this is the part of the diagram where the universe is slowing down because of gravity, just not slowing down much. This is the part of the diagram I figured the universe might be in if it wasn't in this part of the diagram. And then I noticed that although some of these objects were consistent with this part of the diagram, on average, they are not consistent. Now, when I saw this for the first time, I was not just depressed, I was horrified, because that could only mean one thing, which is that I had made a horrible mistake. Okay? Because the universe should not be speeding up. The universe should be slowing down because it's full of gravity. But our data back in 1998 indicated that the universe was speeding up. So we wrote papers. The other team, it turned out, was doing work at the same time as us and wrote a paper at exactly the same time as us and got exactly the same answer. At which point I started thinking that maybe I hadn't made a mistake and my colleagues hadn't made a mistake and that well, as I said, that we should look at this more carefully. And so, just to show you, this work has been done by a huge number of people, and I think when I get to give a talk like this, it's really an honor of the 20 people on our team and the 35 people on the other team who spent many, many years of their lives doing this work. So, people often ask, did we have a eureka moment where we went, yeehaw, we've discovered the accelerating universe? The answer is no, we did not. Adam Riess was a young postdoc in 1997 who was reducing our data feverishly, and we were on the phone continually. And one day he called me up and said, hey, look at this data. I don't understand what's going on. The universe, we measure the total amount of matter in the universe, and this value here is sort of weighing the universe. It's telling you how much stuff is in the universe. And we got a number that was negative. Now, I don't know what negative mass is. And so that sort of told us that the idea of what we were doing, something was funny. And that was the first thing. Now, Adam may have had a eureka moment at that time. This was where I was wondering what we did wrong. And so we didn't really have a eureka moment. Instead, we had a month or two of going over every single thing again in detail, trying to find our mistake. And it was only after a couple months that we sort of realized that maybe we didn't make a mistake, but we were not completely sure. So, an accelerating universe. If you go through and try to figure out what would make the universe accelerate the way we see it, the conclusion that we came up with is that we needed a 30%, 70% mix of normal gravitating matter, so that's stuff like atoms, but there's this other stuff that we know exists called dark matter that also has gravity. So 30% of the universe could be that type of stuff, but we needed 70% of some sort of mystery matter, which was given the name dark energy. And dark energy has to have this funny property of pushing on itself. And sort of dark energy is like anti-gravity. It, instead of, when you have stuff of this type, instead of being attracted, it actually repulses itself effectively. But the reality is, a lot of people were skeptical, including yours truly. This was a crazy result in 1998. So people went out and, of course, started working under other avenues. This is a map of the cosmos I showed you earlier. And it was allowed astronomers to weigh the universe extremely accurately. So where people were actually able to go through and measure with more accuracy than it had ever been done before how much gravitational matter there was in the universe. And so this was done in Australia, and there was a similar program done in New Mexico called the Sloan Program. And when they did this measurement, what they found was that the amount of gravitational material in the universe was 27% of the amount necessary to where the gravity, the material that has gravity, would warp space and make it flat. That just right scenario. So you might say, well, is that a problem? Is that seems different than what I'm saying? Well, I said, no, remember I said that 30% of the universe had to have gravitation and 70% was mystery matter? This experiment completely blind to our mystery matter. Can't see it. Another experiment, the cosmic microwave background, this is from the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe, is looking at these bumps. Now these bumps, as I told you, are the seeds of thousands of galaxies. They represent little places in the universe that are a little denser than other places. And we can use the physics of that, and the physics of these are remarkably simple, and I'm going to sketch it in the simplest detail I can. As material starts to collapse, just like a piston inside of a car engine, it heats up, and it heats up because of pressure. So the pressure and the heat are all mixed together, and the pressure pushes and stops the material from falling gravitationally any further. But pressure doesn't work at the speed of light, it works at the speed of sound. The speed of sound, it turns out, in the earlier universe is very easy to calculate. It's 57% of the speed of light. Now the universe isn't very old at this time, and so the speed of sound, which is how fast pressure can work, times the age of the universe, tells you the size that pressure is able to work at. So the universe is roughly 380,000 years old at this time. The speed of sound is this 57% of the speed light, and that gives us this amazing cosmic ruler. The cosmic ruler tells us the size of the bumps in the early universe. And so I just told you earlier that we didn't have rulers in space. Well, we actually have this one, and it's good to 1%. But we didn't have it until about 5 years ago. So this is a new development. Now, this ruler, of course, isn't nearby. It's back, really right next to the time of the Big Bang. And that allows us to make a very funny measurement of the universe, which is its geometry. Now, this is a fairly sophisticated argument, and I'm sorry if I lose you, but I'll do my best here. So physics is telling us how big those blobs are in the universe. Measurement tells us how big the blobs look now. So if I take a ruler here, and I'm close to you, it looks big. As I get further away, it gets smaller. And we can use that idea to understand the universe. Turns out how big they appear tells us the geometry of space. So this is why. Here is a blue curved, the blue universe is curved, and the flat universe is red. Now, these two objects have the same, they appear the same size, because in the blue universe, the light curves and looks smaller, so objects that are smaller appear the same size as objects that are larger in the other universe. So if we're at Earth looking back, that blob, which is big, is a ruler that's big, appears exactly the same size as that blob, which is smaller. So objects of the same size appear larger in a universe that is curved. More graphically, if you didn't follow that, it's all right. That's the hard part of the lecture. Here's the geometry of the universe done more simply. If you were to model those blobs, and you just assume that we can do it, in a universe that is infinite and has this saddle shape, that's what the universe should look like. If it is flat, just right, should look like this. And if it's finite, it should look like that. The blobs are bigger in the closed universe. Well, the Wilkinson, you know, I've shown you that map. It turns out that's exactly what they look like. If you go through in detail, the universe has 102%, plus or minus 2% of the material necessary to be flat. Now, this may seem confusing because it turns out that the geometry of space is not just affected by matter that gravitates normally. It's affected by any type of matter we can dream up. And one thing I've learned is theorists can dream up anything. So if we put this all together, I'm going to do some cosmic subtraction for you. The cosmic microwave background says the total of everything is 102%. The experiments that weigh the universe and see how much stuff has gravity find 27%. I subtract that, and I get 75% of mystery matter. The same mystery matter, it would seem, that the supernovae are seeing accelerate the cosmos. So when these things happened roughly 5 years ago, I went from being kind of ashamed of seeing an accelerating universe to being proud because it appeared to more or less be consistent. But we have a very messy universe. If we put everything together, these numbers are going to be slightly different, but this is our best view of the cosmos today. 72% of the universe is this mystery matter we call dark energy. 28% of the universe is gravitating matter. Now, a topic of another talk entirely is understanding dark matter versus atomic matter. If we go through the details of many other experiments, it turns out that only 4% of the universe is made up of the atoms that you and I are made up of. 7 times more material is something called dark matter, which we think might possibly be some undiscovered particle that probably zips right through the Earth, that is just, we're hoping, possibly the Large Hadron Collider or a satellite will eventually figure out. So we have an idea. Dark energy, no clue. So I'm telling you today that we understand the universe very well, but 96% of it, well, we're not really sure about. Well, our best guess on dark energy goes back to Einstein, and I alluded to this earlier. He invented something called the cosmological constant. When he formulated his theories of gravitation, he realized the universe should be in motion. And so he created this anti-gravity stuff, which was energy tied to space, that counteracted the gravitational attraction of the Earth. He later described this as his greatest blunder. And one thing I love about Einstein is what he considered to be his greatest blunder is certainly my greatest discovery. Such is what was the man Einstein was. As I say, what we think of it now is the cosmological constant represents the energy of the vacuum. So this is telling you what's in space when you think nothing is there. It's saying that every piece of space, if this is correct, has an energy associated with it. And when you make more space, you make more energy associated with the space. That type of stuff pushes on itself and will accelerate the cosmos. Now, it turns out that we really have a battle for domination in the universe between dark energy and dark matter. Dark matter, so this is stuff that has gravity. This could be some undiscovered particle I've already talked about. But as the universe expands, the amount of dark matter stays the same. You're not creating dark matter. It's the, you know, one atom is always one atom. One dark matter particle is always one dark matter particle. And so its density as the universe expands, gets smaller and smaller, and so its effect, its gravitational effect, decreases over time. Dark energy, on the other hand, is tied to space itself. So as the universe expands, dark energy gets created with the expanding space. And so it becomes stronger relative to dark matter over time. Once dark energy starts ripping the universe apart, there's no going back, assuming the dark energy stays the same. This is another thing that theorists like to do. They like to take dark energy and make it be able to do anything they want in the future, and that's one of the problems for observers like me. I can only look back in the past. So everything I'm telling you tonight is assuming that things don't radically change in the future. So let's take a look at what this means. We have a universe slowing down initially because it's full of dark matter. But as the universe gets bigger and bigger, the dark matter becomes more and more diffuse, and dark energy is eventually able to take over. And the dark energy then expands the universe over time faster and faster. So this tells us if we can look far enough into the universe's past, the universe shouldn't be speeding up anymore. It should be slowing down. So here's the most distant object ever, a supernova ever detected in the universe. I'm going to show you exactly how far we can go. So this is an image taken with the Hubble Space Telescope of an 11 billion year old supernova. That object showed that the universe was actually slowing down just as predicted 11 billion years ago. So everything seems frighteningly consistent. So what is our goal now? Well, the goal now is to understand dark energy better, because right now we sort of know it exists and we don't know much else. And the thing that the theorists are looking at is whether or not dark energy is the Einstein's version, where it's exactly tied to space, doesn't change ever. Or if it does something different and it changes over time. And so as energy, as space gets created, is there a little bit extra or a little bit less energy created compared to when space is created? So if I double space, do I get double the amount of dark energy, or do I get a little more or a little less? That's really the big question. And this has been listed as one of the big physics questions of the decade in many, many places, including, I should have Canada up here, because Canada has actually done some of the most interesting work over the last 3 or 4 years, along with France, using the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope, at understanding this. What happens? Imagine Einstein is right. The universe gets bigger and bigger. There's more and more dark energy, and the dark energy gets exactly created with space. Well, once parts of the universe start to expand, dark energy takes over and makes things expand faster and faster, exponentially faster, it turns out. So dark energy gets created exactly as space gets created. Dark energy has won the battle of the universe then, and will continue to accelerate the cosmos into the future. Eventually, the creation of space happens more quickly than light can travel through it. remembering that motion between galaxies is not a velocity, it's actually the creation of space. And so if that space gets created so quickly, the photon loses its ability to make progress through space as it expands. What does this mean? Well, this becomes a very sad day for cosmology, because eventually we're going to end in a universe which we can't do any cosmology in. We live in a universe where our galaxy, now remember, our galaxy, gravity has won. The universe has collapsed. The universe is not expanding in our galaxy. It's not expanding in this room. Are the forces of nature other than dark energy have won the battle here. So we're not going to expand. So anything that is gravitationally bound right now, where gravity holds it together, keeps space from expanding, dark energy hasn't won. And so that means that the nearest galaxies in us will collapse to form a huge galaxy, but everything else will eventually get expanded away from our ability to see it. So we're going to look out into an empty universe. And so that is a universe, as I say, people like me are out of a job. And so in about 100 billion years, cosmologists, they're just not going to be here. We're all going to be stellar astronomers. All right. More exciting. Now, this is extremely speculative. Imagine dark energy instead gets created just a little faster than space is created. It turns out then that type of dark energy can actually creep into where gravity has already expanded the universe and won, or already collapsed the universe and won. So there is no safe place in the universe here. This type of stuff causes every piece of the universe to eventually be accelerated faster than the speed of light can get to every other piece of the universe at the subatomic level. That would leave nothing. At least a very good definition of nothing. We'd be down into little quarks or something. I'm not even sure what we'd break down into. Now, again, very speculative. This is quite interesting because the final processes of this really only last 15 or 20 minutes. You would see the stars sort of disappear, and then 15 minutes later you would be ripped to shreds. It would all be very quick. It'd be very exciting, but again, it would be a good way to go. You gotta admit it'd be a good way to go. But that, again, is 100 billion years in the future minimum. So we probably don't have to worry. Anyway, so I will finish there and just leave you with the thought that that's how the universe ends. Not with a gnab, but a whimper, or just possibly in a scream during the big rip. Thank you very much.
I was just wondering, I'm wondering if the definition of dark energy, I recall reading that they've done experiments where two plates in a vacuum, very close together, are actually pushed apart by the generation of virtual particles. And those particles create a pressure which is capable of pushing very small and close objects apart. Is it possible that dark energy is actually the cumulative effect of this force?
So that effect, called the Casimir effect, is often tied to dark energy. So the idea of dark energy, and this is one of the problems with dark energy, if you go through and you say, how many virtual particles, which is the thing that's leading to this effect you're talking about, potentially, exist in the universe, and you sort of do your best guess from first principles of quantum field theory, you get an answer which is 10 to 120 times, so that's a 1 with 120 zeros, too big of a force. So we have a problem, which is that that would mean that the universe would have lasted a millisecond and then been ripped apart. And so it's sort of one of the biggest problems in physics. It's sort of known as being the biggest mistake in physics, that one, is that our best guess is the universe should be 10 to 120 times, have a larger value of this dark energy, 120 orders of magnitude larger than visible. So theorists, and I love this, say, well, we don't understand that, so it's quite obvious that something must cancel out, we don't know what it is, so it's zero. Okay? That being said, if you want to go through and say, well, maybe things cancel out to one part in the 120th decimal place, that's pretty hard to swallow. That's what we call fine-tuning. And so the answer is, I don't know. It's quite clear that the effect that you talk about, which is still quite controversial, that the order of magnitude of that effect is this literally 120 orders of magnitude larger, or maybe I think it may be 55 orders of magnitude larger than what we have measured. And so there's something going on where that's not the whole story, if it's the story at all. But it's a good question.
My question is that if you interpret dark energy as energy of the vacuum, does that suggest that energy is not conserved in time?
So it turns out that we have all been taught in high school physics of the conservation of energy. Believe it or not, under Einstein's equations of general relativity in the universe as it evolves, energy is not conserved in the way you were taught in high school. However, things are conserved that are analogous to energy in Einstein's equations. And so it turns out those things are conserved with dark energy, but energy is not conserved over the universe as a whole. And so it is, as I said, don't think you're going to get away with creating energy locally somehow. Einstein doesn't let you get away with that. But it's unfortunately, in the terms that we think of energy conservation, does not work exactly the same as we've been taught.
I don't understand when you talk about dark energy gets created as space gets created.
Yep.
Because my understanding is that you're measuring matter that's moving away from each other and occupying space. The space is there, but the matter is moving into more space. So I don't quite understand your definition of space being created. It's out there, and the galaxies are moving outwards into more space. There's a definition of universe thing that I have a problem
so
with.
So it's really
here.
All within the framework of general relativity, and so if you go through and look at how general relativity works, it's not that galaxies are moving through space. They're actually tied to space itself. And it's the space that's being stretched in between them. That is the general relativistic view of the universe. But it doesn't have to be your view. I see you shaking your head, which is fine. It's not the... We have to understand about science is that we know general relativity is not perfectly correct. We know, we've never shown it to be wrong, but we know that at the quantum mechanical level, it doesn't work. And so it doesn't mean general relativity is correct. It's the framework by which we understand things. Now, it's a very powerful framework because although I've had to add this abomination of dark matter and dark energy to this theory, it's still an extremely simple theory that has allowed us to go through and predict effectively everything we can see. And what no one else has been able to do is to come up with an alternative theory which will do better over everything. There are theories which are very complicated, much more complicated than general relativity. They have a lot of little dials. And there are things which will do one part of it, but not everything. And so it's all right to be skeptical. But from my perspective, I'm just testing the best thing. And I'm always looking for problems. And at this point, this model does make some predictions, which we're continuing to test. But at this point, it does cover everything we've made, although it is not a pretty theory. And it would surprise me if it's perfectly correct. But whether or not we'll be able to sort that out in my lifetime, we'll see. I'm trying. I become famous for showing it's wrong, not by showing it's right.
Hello, not a technical question, but if the universe is expanding, then the Big Bang was a one-way process or operation. But if the universe started from, a singularity, which was nothing, is that something that we could see as, is it a cyclical process?
So this is a big question. I think aesthetically we would love for the universe to be a cyclical process. The reality is when we wind the universe back in time, we can see it 300,000 years, when it was 300,000 years old directly, that's that cosmic microwave background. We can infer what's going on when it's about 20 seconds or to a few minutes old by how much hydrogen and helium there are in the universe. And if we take our accelerator physics, such as what the Large Hadron Collider will show us when it has its warranty service done on it, we could probably go back to when the universe is a milliseconds old or thereabouts, maybe even a little earlier. The problem is it's very tough to go back before that. And so, you know, we talk about the universe potentially being a singularity, but we can't run it that far back into the past. And so I think it remains an open question for theory, and potentially in the future we'll be able to use gravity waves, which actually can travel through the universe at these very early times and still reach us, to get some insights to those earliest times. But at this time, you know, it's very difficult to make pronouncements. Most things are possible at this point, at that time.
Hadron Collider supposedly gonna make small dark matter. Has anybody ever dreamed of making something to make dark energy?
So dark energy, the reason people think we might be able to make some dark matter in a collider is because our best guess is that it is a particle. Now, it turns out particles never push in the normal way on themselves that we need dark energy to be. The amount of dark energy that we seem to have dreamed up in our universe is a tiny amount even in something the size of the Earth. So there's no obvious way to create it in accelerators, unfortunately. It's such a diffuse material, it's only because we can add it up over the vastness of space that it has an effect at all. And so it's really tough stuff to get our hands on experimentally as we now understand it. But the good news is things are so uncertain, it might be able to manifest itself in some subtle way. Some people think that it's possibly dimensions other than the four that Einstein uses to describe the universe coming into play, and that might have a funny way to find itself on the way gravity works on very small scales, or potentially the way various things behave in the universe, which I'm not going to go into now. But I'm afraid that dark energy probably not going to be created in a collider, or if it is, it's going to be a heck of a surprise for us.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.